Welcome back to the Enlightened Primates Podcast. Thank you for listening. I hope this morning or this evening or this workout or walk or boring work day or maybe going to sleep is going well for you. This here is called What the Heck Happened This Month, September 2024 version. This month has been a beast, especially looking back at it. A lot of things happened this month. And goodness, now that we're at the end and I can look back and kind of add all this stuff up. Wow. All right, well, let's start at the beginning. Back in July, I believe it was, this fella snuck up on a roof during one of Trump's campaign speeches and managed to get off at least 3 shots. I haven't seen the final count of how many shots he got off, but he apparently grazed Trump's ear and injured one person and unfortunately murdered a fireman who was there, and that gentleman passed away, sadly. This sparked a lot of talk about the failure of the Secret Service, specifically law enforcement in general. The gun person, the murderer, the dead murderer, was on a roof, and as I understand it, directly below him was the command center for the local authorities. People saw him on the roof. People saw him flying a drone around. People saw him using a rangefinder. Saw him climb on the roof with a rifle. And he still managed to get off at least 3 shots. Well, following that unsuccessful attempt, on September 15th this month, Donald Trump was golfing at one of his golf courses in West Palm Beach with a friend and donor named Steve Witkoff. He was walking along the 5th hole when a Secret Service agent conducted a sweep of the 6th hole ahead of him for any threats. During the sweep, a man was seen aiming a rifle at the agent while hiding in shrubs approximately 400 yards away. The position in which the man had been is well known as a spot frequently used by paparazzi to photograph Trump at his golf course. At 1:31 p.m., approximately 12 hours after the gunman's 1:59 a.m. arrival, the agent, having seen the rifle barrel move, fired at the man, who dropped his weapon and fled in a vehicle. After the shot was fired, Trump was escorted off the course by his Secret Service protective detail. The man did not have a clear line of sight on Trump and did not fire his gun. A witness took a photo of the suspect's vehicle, assisting authorities in tracking it down. Golf course was locked down. They eventually caught the dude in a black Nissan SUV. Martin County Sheriff's Office deputies forced the driver out of his car after they pulled it over and arrested him. The sheriff's units waited, quote-unquote, a while to stop the vehicle to avoid engaging in a high-speed chase. They removed an SKS-style rifle with the removed serial number, a scope, 2 backpacks containing ceramic tiles that could deflect a bullet, a plastic bag containing food, a GoPro camera, were all recovered at the scene. Shortly after the incident, authorities identified the suspect as Ryan Wesley Ralph, a 58-year-old Hawaiian resident who lived for most of his life in Greensboro, North Carolina. He had a history of political activity online and offline, with his political engagement dating back to at least 1996. But let's see. Voting records showed that he did not vote in the 2016 elections, but in a 2020 Twitter post, he claimed to have voted for Trump in 2016 and later regretted it. In a self-published ebook in 2023, he wrote about his supposed previous support for Trump, saying, "I am man enough to say that I misjudged and made a terrible mistake." He reached out to Iran in his book, saying they should feel free to assassinate Trump for the United States' withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as well as Routh himself for supporting Trump in the past. Routh condemned the January 6th Capitol attack as being perpetrated by Donald Trump and his undemocratic posse. Routh had multiple prior criminal charges, including a 2002 conviction for possessing a weapon of mass death and destruction after barricading himself in a building with a fully automatic weapon. As part of the plea deal, he agreed to undergo a mental health evaluation and accept recommended treatments. He had over 100 criminal counts filed against him in North Carolina, which included driving violation and possession of stolen items. Routh typically received parole or probation for his offenses, with no record of time that he was in prison. That's interesting. I did not know about that last paragraph. Well, after a little bit of Googling, I still don't really know too much about that last paragraph. I did find a Wired article dated September 15, 2024, titled "Suspected Trump Gunman Was Once Charged with Possession of a Weapon of Mass Destruction." In this article, the very last paragraph says, quote, Falk says Routh was well known for getting into armed confrontations with the police. "I wasn't the only one who had a standoff with him," she says. "We always knew he had weapons. Guilford County court records show Routh was charged dozens of times, often for driving-related offenses, going back into the early 80s. In regards to why he wasn't in jail, folks says, all we can do is arrest them, and then obviously it goes into the court system, and they decide all of that. It's frustrating at times." The Greensboro Police Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment, nor did a lawyer who represented Routh in his 2003 divorce. Interesting. This dude used to be a construction worker in North Carolina, and it sounds like he stepped on a banana and flipped his wig at some point in the past. Or maybe his team lost the Super Bowl and he just lost it. I don't know, but he even went to Russia. Let's see, I just saw that a second ago. Yeah. Newsweek reported Routh had claimed to have fought in Ukraine, while he told the New York Times he did not fight in Ukraine. Oh, great. Routh said in a 2022 interview with a Romanian reporter in Kiev that he flew to Ukraine to join the army in the months after Russia's full-scale invasion, but learned that he was not an ideal candidate for the battlefield because he was in his mid-50s with no military experience. Later in 2020, Routh said in an interview that after he was rejected for military service, he began recruiting volunteer soldiers for the Ukrainian military. Routh complained of roadblocks to Ukraine, admitting foreign fighters, telling the publication Semaphore that Ukraine is very often hard to work with. They're afraid that anybody and everybody is a Russian spy. Routh was filmed at an April 2022 protest in Independence Square in Kiev. A former volunteer for Ukraine's International Legion, Evelyn Ashenbrenner, branded Routh as delusional and a liar over his claims that he recruited for the Ukrainian organization, saying Routh was not and never has been associated with the International Legion or the Ukrainian Armed Forces at all. Ashenbrenner said of Routh, quote, he was combative, he was argumentative, he refused repeatedly to understand basic army policy, and quote, further adding, quote, there were delusions of grandeur, that's what I figured, and he was very disconnected from reality, end quote. The International Legion for the Defense of Ukraine said in a statement that Routh had never been part of, associated with, or linked to it in any capacity. There we go. A for real lone wolf terrorist. That's what one looks like, ladies and gentlemen. But there's more. His son, it appears, has been arrested on federal charges of possessing child pornography. Investigators found hundreds of files with child pornography during an unrelated search. I would imagine searching for evidence related to his father and his attempted assassination of a former sitting president of the United States. His name is Oren. He faces two charges, receipt and possession of child pornography. The child pornography was found on Samsung Galaxy Note devices in his bedroom and in his possession. Unrelated, but goodness gracious. I can only imagine what goes on in that house. Well, there's nobody living there anymore. I've not seen anything suggesting wife, mother, or other siblings. So that might have just been Oren and Ryan in the Routh household. While we're speaking of terrorists, this next item. I recognize that there are always two sides of every story. And this story being Israel and Lebanon. I do not understand the Middle East. I especially don't understand what goes on in the Gaza Strip, why there's so much hate for Israel all over the world. Why people seem to think it's okay for people to, enemies of Israel, to rocket attack them, to blow up buildings, blow up cars, kidnap their people. To me, that seems like the act of terrorist. Is it justified? I have no idea. But I'm going to use the word terrorist because the way that Hezbollah acts seems to me to be terroristic. So I'm going to color my comments of this next story from that perspective. If I'm wrong about it, I'm wrong about it. I'm sure there's nuance, as there is everywhere. I'm sure somebody could sit down and justify everything Hezbollah does. I'm sure a different person could sit down and justify everything Israel has done. I'm not getting in the middle of it. I'm looking at it strictly from a country protecting itself from terrorists. And in my mind, you could substitute the United States in Israel's place, except for us it's ISIS, where for them it's Hezbollah. And I would be just as comfortable saying about the United States as what I'm about to say here about Israel and about Hezbollah as I would be with saying the same thing about ISIS or the Taliban. Israel has pulled off this month something that, as I understand, they've been working on for years. And it was a multifaceted offensive. Just when we thought things were, well, let me start at the beginning. On the 17th and 18th of this month, I started seeing stories in the news. There was one, two, and then hundreds. It was all over the Twitterverse that the pagers that Hezbollah uses to communicate with each other were blowing up in the hands of those terrorists. At the end of day one, I think we were up to like 50 something killed, of course, including a little girl, and hundreds, I think up to 500 wounded. And we're not talking about little scratches. A lot of people lost their eyes because the pager waited long enough to get up to their face so that they could read it before it detonated. A lot of fingers lost. A lot of people that checked their pagers while they were still on their belt lost thighs, groins, livers, kidneys. And for a military offensive, I cannot think of, over the course of my life or anything that I've ever read, something so precisely devastating to an enemy as this pager attack. It was absolutely brilliant. No bomb, no direct action by troops on the ground. There's not a rocket, there's not a laser, there is no piece of weaponry in any country's army that I'm aware of that could carry out such a precision attack with such a low percentage of collateral damage. Directly, just about guaranteed to hit those and only those who it was intended to. What I haven't seen yet is how did they know the numbers of these cats? The pager numbers. Because none were accidentally blown up in airplanes. None that I read of were accidentally or purposefully detonated inside Israel's borders. Everything happened. It was almost like they knew exactly where all these terrorists were at exactly the right time and sent this pager signal, however they did it, to minimize the damage to innocent civilians and to maximize the damage to the terrorist. This went on for the first day. And let's see, Wikipedia's numbers. I just grabbed Wikipedia because it's all, of course, highly political, and I figured this would be at least middle ground, leaning left a bit. Let's see, 17 September, killing at least 12 people, including two Hezbollah members, which isn't true, and two children. I believe the children part, and wounding more than 2,750, including Iran's ambassador to Lebanon. And I have not seen anything in the news about that particular item since then. So Hezbollah figured out this wasn't an accident. It wasn't defective pagers. It wasn't batteries heating up and exploding like the internet was ablaze with early on in the day on the 17th. I would imagine by the end of the 17th, the leadership in Hezbollah said, we need to quit using pagers. These pagers are exploding. Something's going on. Let's switch to another method of communication. So they went to using walkie-talkies. And it just gets better. The next day, during funerals, where Hezbollah members were gathered together to mourn the passing of their buddies, holding their walkie-talkies, and walkie-talkies started exploding all over the place across Lebanon and Syria. And Israel, that was just the opening salvo of what now has turned into a armed invasion across the border. I saw that just a few minutes ago. It looks like actual troop transports and tanks are headed across the border. The day after the walkie-talkie attack, they started dropping bombs on high-ranked Hezbollah members. The leader of Hezbollah was killed a couple days ago in a bombing. The dude The next guy in line stepped up. They dropped 6 bunker bombs in his bunker, destroyed it. He crawled into a hole somewhere and died in toxic gases. He was in power, I think, about an hour. I don't know if the power has been transferred over to the third person yet. I've not followed this story the last couple days. But Israel is done. They are headed to war. Switching gears. I guess this one's more of a right leaning / tinfoil hat-ish story. It looks like a company backed by George Soros named Odyssey Incorporated was granted by the FCC the power to purchase ownership of over 200 radio stations. Now, if you're familiar with Soros, if you're familiar with the manipulation that he's capable of, this dude's supposed to be a gabillionaire, then of course you're going to ascribe any action that he takes with some concern, right? Unless you're just a staunch Democrat. So this was fast-tracked through Friday, I believe it was. I think I saw it Friday morning, and by the end of the day, they'd passed it. They'd approved it. During a House Oversight Committee hearing last week, FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr voiced concern for the shortcut the FCC has created for this decision. He said the FCC is not following its normal process for reviewing a transaction. We have established over a number of years one way in which you can get approval from the FCC when you have an excess of 25% foreign ownership, which this transaction does. It seems to me that the FCC is poised to create for the first time an entirely new shortcut. Despite the unprecedented nature of this action, the FCC majority has apparently decided to approve licenses on an accelerated time frame for a company in which George Soros has a major ownership stake and with stations in 40 media markets, reaching more than 165 million Americans. By all appearances, the FCC majority isn't just expediting, but is bypassing an established process to do a favor for George Soros and facilitate his influence over hundreds of radio stations before the November election. The expedited decision will ensure that Odyssey Incorporated, in which George Soros, a Democrat mega donor, and his company Soros Fund Management are acquiring a major equity stake, will continue to maintain broadcast licenses for their over 200 radio stations. That's pretty creepy, in my opinion. Why would the FCC get involved in that? Number one, well, because of the percentage of foreign ownership. Two, I would like to have seen them kick that back and say no. Because doesn't that creep over there into the monopoly side of things? Aren't there anti-monopoly laws? And how come this doesn't fall within the boundaries defined in those laws? I'm kind of curious to see where this goes. It's, like I said, this is still kind of a relatively new story. Maybe late last week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, somewhere in there, this first kind of bubbled to the surface of Twitter. So we'll see what happens. Who listens to radio anymore? Actually, I do. I like to listen to AM radio on weekends. I like to listen to The Weeknds with Michael Brown. I think Michael Brown's got this sort of grandfatherly, caring voice, and he's very rational. I like that about him. And then there's a show on Saturday mornings. I want to say it's This Old House, but that's not what it's called. It's like home improvement type information. I've got stains in my concrete. What's the best way to remove them? And I'm replacing the plumbing in my sink. What does my whatever? It's that kind of stuff. It's kind of an interesting show. But, I mean, that's for maybe an hour on Saturday and maybe an hour on Sunday if I'm out driving around. Aside from that, I'm listening to podcasts. So this purchase doesn't bother me so much personally, but I do look and see, go listen to popular music. Just pick a pop station. I couldn't even recommend one. Local pop station. Listen to the top 10 songs or don't. Just figure out what their titles and artists are. And then go look up the lyrics for those songs. Once you get a sense of what they're about, what the most popular music is, and don't be mistaken, popular music is not defined by the audience. Popular music is defined by record companies and radio stations, by big media. There is where this permission from the FCC bothers me. And it really drives the point home when you look at the content of the garbage that spews out of FM radio. Prove me wrong. Take a look at the lyrics, and if you find a song that doesn't corrupt good values and that encourages people to make good decisions, to improve themselves, their lives, the lives of those around them, maybe a song that talks about how to give back to the system or helping a fellow out. Hit me on Instagram if you find something. I'll be glad to come back and talk some more about this if you can prove me wrong. Switching gears again. Goodness, this month. With hours to go before their labor contract expired, this is a story from today. With hours to go before the labor contract expired, longshoremen on the East and Gulf Coast prepared on Monday to go on strike at midnight, halting most activity at some of the busiest U.S. ports. The walkout by members of the International Longshoremen's Association after a months-long standoff in negotiations would cost the economy billions of dollars a day. President Biden can use a federal labor law to force the longshoremen back to work, but on Sunday he said he was not considering using that power. I wonder if he was probably too busy considering what flavor ice cream he was having that night. But I digress. In recent days, top government officials have pressed both sides to reach a deal. The stakes are very high, Governor Kathy Hochul of New York said at a news conference on Monday. The potential for disruption is significant, she added. However, that shortages were not expected and consumers need not stockpile food. Oh, yes. You know, any governor telling me anything about what I need to do or what not to expect is nonsense. Because I very vaguely remember during the COVID years all the things we were told not to worry about and to worry about. And it seemed like every single one of them we're wrong. The ILA, which has 47,000 members, has not held a strike at all the East and Gulf Coast ports since 1977. The Union and the United States Maritime Alliance, the employer's negotiating group, are at loggerheads over wages and benefits. The union is also resisting the use of automated machinery at the ports. The union has its own negotiating group. United States Maritime Alliance. Interesting. There is no practical alternative to the East and Gulf Coast ports for moving many goods in and out of the eastern half of the country. And the ports can't operate without longshoremen, who move metal boxes, call containers, on and off ships, and handle other economically crucial cargo like cars and heavy machinery, and medicine, and rice, and batteries, and electronics, and all that stuff you order on Amazon. Fearing a strike, many businesses ordered goods early so that they cleared the East and Gulf Coast ports before Tuesday, but much cargo didn't make it through in time and could be stranded at sea. Remember when that happened during COVID? Even if a strike is short, it could take weeks to clear the backlog. Remember when that happened during COVID? Under the current contract, which expires on Monday, longshoremen earn a top rate of $39 an hour. The ILA is asking for... This is on the East and Gulf Coast now, before I finish this paragraph. This is not California. This is on the East Coast. $39 an hour is pretty darn good money, especially if you have no college degree. Especially if you haven't become an expert at doing something where you're a master of this or like an expert at that. $39 an hour is great money. The ILA is asking for a $5 an hour raise for each of the 6 years of the new contract, which would put them at $69 an hour in the final year of the contract. The pay of West Coast longshoremen will rise to $60.85 an hour in 2027, the last year of their contract. With overtime and shift work, a longshoreman's income can exceed $200,000, but longshoremen say they have put in long work weeks to make that much money. Yeah, 40 hours plus 10 hours of overtime. I know people who work a lot more than that for a lot less than that and feel like they're doing really well. And they're not sitting in big machines that pick up boxes and move them around. Like, they're actually around the chemicals and around the manufacturing facilities, working alongside and inside large, noisy, dangerous, loud, huge machines that, if they make a single misstep, would swallow them and not even notice. I'm talking about paper mill workers, machinists, folks building ships. These cats have America over a barrel. This isn't really like the United Auto Workers Union going on strike, because who cares? Well, who's going to starve to death or lose their business for lack of supplies if Ford adds a two-month delay or a six-month delay to the delivery of their brand new truck? This strike closes ports and lock up the East Coast. Exports, folks who make things and send them out, nope, they're not leaving. You can get them to the port, but it's not getting loaded on a ship. Coming the other direction too. This one's going to be interesting. And back to a bit of good news. Elon Musk wins again. SpaceX. Well, let me say this. couple months ago, Boeing launched their Starliner, I believe it's called, and got two astronauts up to the International Space Station. They had plans to be there for 2 days. 2 days. And they were supposed to get a ride back home. The Starliner was grounded by NASA after a cascade of thruster troubles and helium leaks, which marred its trip to the orbiting complex. But then comes Elon. I think they've been up there for about a month now, and they're expected to stay through the end of the year. But SpaceX launched a rescue mission for the two stuck astronauts at the ISS on Saturday, sending up a downsized crew to bring them home, but not until next year. I imagine they're probably glad to get some fresh draws and some new food. The capsule rocketed into orbit to fetch the test pilots whose Boeing spacecraft returned to Earth empty earlier this month because of safety concerns. The switch and rods left it to NASA's Nick Hague and Russia's Alexander Gorbunov to retrieve Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams. Because NASA rotates space station crews approximately every 6 months, this newly launched flight with two empty seats reserved for Wilmore and Williams won't return until late February. Officials say there wasn't a way to bring them back earlier on SpaceX without interrupting other scheduled missions. By the time they return, the pair will have logged more than 8 months in space. They expected to be gone just a week. I said 2 days, it was a week when they signed up for Boeing's first astronaut flight that launched in June. Imagine going somewhere for a week and getting stuck there for 8 months. But. There are some folks who are facing a very similar dilemma, and we will get to that in just a bit. To put a little context around this longshoreman strike. Here is a short clip from the president of that union. Now, I believe there's a caveat here that you should keep in mind while hearing this. One, that may color how you receive it. I'm not sure whether this guy is addressing his comments towards the businesses that own the docks, the American people, the federal government. I'm not sure. This clip does not really give a whole lot of context. Keeping that in mind, take a listen.
But today's world, it's changing into the future. They're not making millions no more. They're making billions. And they're spending it fast as they make it. I want a piece of that for my men. Because when they made their most money was during COVID. When my men had to go to work on those piers every single day, when everybody stayed home and went to work. Not my men. They died out there with the virus. We all got sick with the virus. We kept them going. From Canada to Maine to Texas, Great Lakes, Puerto Rico, now the Bahamas, everybody went to work during COVID. Nobody stayed home. Well, I want to be compensated for that. I'm not asking for the world. They know what I want. They know what I want. And if they don't, well, then I have to go into the street and we have to fight for what we rightfully deserve. These people today don't know what a strike is. Right. When my men hit the streets from Maine to Texas, every single port a lockdown. You know what's going to happen? I'll tell you. First week, be all over the news every night, boom, boom. Second week, guys who sell cars can't sell cars because the cars ain't coming in off the ships. They get laid off. Third week, malls start closing down. They can't get the goods from China. They can't sell clothes. They can't do this. Everything in the United States comes on a ship. They go out of business. construction workers get laid off because the materials aren't coming in. The steel's not coming in. The lumber's not coming in. They lose their job. Everybody's hating the longshoremen now because now they realize how important our jobs are. Now I have the president screaming at me, I'm putting a Taft Hartley on you. Go ahead. Taft Hartley means I have to go back to work for 90 days. That's a cooling off period. Do you think when I go back for 90 days, those men are going to go to work on that pier? It's going to cost the money, the company's money to pay their salaries. Well, they went from 30 moves an hour, maybe to 8. They're going to be like this. Who's going to win here in the long run? You're better off sitting down and let's get a contract and let's move on with this world. And in today's world, I'll cripple you. I will cripple you. And you have no idea what that means. Nobody does.
He got a bit threatening there at the end of that, didn't he? On the other side of that argument, and regardless of whether you're pro-union or not, I've seen this issue so many times over the years. I've worked around unions, never been a member of one. I think that they have their place and time, and I kind of think that that time is not now anymore. Regardless of where you think that union money goes, there's that whole aspect. Interestingly enough, the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, has a union. Why would they need a union? I don't know. It seems like a conflict of interest to me. But I saw a story last week where they chose not to endorse Kamala. They're just holding their endorsement this election, which I thought was quite interesting, and disappeared the same day after the story came out. Here's a woman that gives her opinion. I guess her husband is a union member. This is the Trump? Other side of the argument.
We want fucking Trump. Support our fucking long...
Here comes some language,
shame
by the way.
Shame on you, longshoremen and dock workers. Shame on you, lady, for buying into the bullshit media that these multi-billion dollar companies are putting out, trying to turn the American public against the longshoremen. You are the fucking problem. A contract is redone between the ILA and the companies every 6 years. The last contract, the companies agreed not to automate. And guess what? They did it the fuck anyway. The companies broke their contract. The longshoremen could have done this strike months ago when they found out about the illegal automation, but they decided not to. They decided to uphold their end of the contract. They decided to be the bigger people. And you're sitting here screaming shame on them. They're the ones that have kept your country running for fucking decades. All the shit you get in your grocery store because our country refuses to fucking make it themselves. The longshoremen are the ones that fucking get it to you. All these multi-billion dollar foreign companies that control what American workers make, when American workers can work, is fucking pathetic. And you are buying into their bullshit. Don't Republicans always scream, oh, don't listen to the mainstream media, it's fake news. Guess what? They say it because it's fucking true. Republican, Trump supporter here. Republican, Trump supporter here. ILA member going on strike in 7 hours because these companies broke their fucking contract. You have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. Shame on you. Shame on you for spreading lies and disinformation. Shame on you for trying to shame our longshoremen who work dangerous fucking jobs. My husband works over 100 hours a week to make sure that the American people get what they need. And these companies think they're just allowed to break fucking contracts. That is not okay. My husband spends more time at work than he does at home to make sure you get what you need. Now they are asking these companies to remove the illegal automation that they put in, breaking their contract, and they are asking for fucking job security. All this bullshit about the 77% pay increase, yeah, that's a starting off point for negotiation over the next six
fucking years. But that's all these multi-billion dollar companies are putting out for you to see, trying to make the longshoremen look greedy, trying to make the longshoremen look bad. And you're buying it. Get your head out of your ass. These are American workers who break their backs for the American people.
Well, that was rather elegant. One point that I have a small niggling disagreement with that rant on is that the longshoremen are out there doing what they do for the American people. That may be an effect of what they're doing, but they don't go to work to meet the needs of the American people. They go to work to support their families. How do they do that? They do that by getting paid for the time that they spend at work. So they're going to work to make money and to support their families, not to support the American people. Does that change the argument? I don't know. They want more money. They're willing to go on strike and not make money unless the union has a contract in it or they have strike insurance so that they could get paid while they're on strike. I don't know. I'm not getting into the right or wrong of that. But I think it will be interesting from my telescopic view of the situation to watch as it develops and see the direct effects to the economy, to consumer goods, to the price of bread on the shelf, to the price of cars on the lot, et cetera, et cetera. I've read that each day this strike is in place cost the United States economy $1 billion. And 3 days, I believe it was. So for every day, we lose 3 days worth of production, shipping goods, both imports and exports. So we wind up getting behind. If the strike is 1 day long, we've really lost 3 days worth of production. So it will take 9 days to get back to where we were before the strike, something like that. So you can see once we get into a couple weeks, 2 weeks, a month, a couple months, and it's going to take a long time to get caught back up again. And goods and services, not services necessarily, but consumer goods sitting in cargo ships outside the docks and ports and backed up out into the ocean could see spoilage. So fruit and vegetables, maybe, that we import. I don't know what the percentage of that is. Goods that can deteriorate if not consumed quickly, just in time, quote unquote, could be lost or spoiled. And that means that the supply that we had planned to have available doesn't get delivered, deteriorates and spoils on the ship before it's ever unloaded. So then the next shipment behind it, maybe leaving right now from China or wherever it's delivered from, was supposed to be here in 2 weeks. Well, it gets here in 2 weeks, just hypothetically. They're still on strike. The first ship has bad goods on it now. The second ship has bad goods on it now. Plus, they haven't made any money from selling those goods. I see the power that this dude has. How is that in one man's hand? Is it strictly up to the union president? Hopefully there's a board. Hopefully they poll the union members and it's a collective opinion, a collective vote to decide as a union team, I think they're called maybe, to go on strike. If, back to this point again, the concern for the choice of career or for them going to work every day is for the American people. This decision sure isn't for the good of American people or the American economy or the American small business owner, the American consumer who counts on those goods being delivered on time. It seems a bit counterproductive. but it is what it is. I'll keep a pulse on this and update at my next podcast. And now we move on to President Biden and Vice President Harris. First of all, she has shown up on more television interviews than I recall her being on the entirety of this presidency, which is good for some, but for others that can't stand to hear what she has to say and how long it takes her to not say it, this is way more. I think we should go back to radio silence from Vice President Harris. I've choked down quite a few of these interviews. I watched her stumble her way through Oprah. I watched Oprah have to bail her out. I've seen her on a podcast with a couple NBA players, former NBA players. I'm not sure which. I'll play you the clip of that from just a minute. I can sum up everything that I've heard from her so far with 3 points. One, she's a bit of a chameleon. If she's speaking in front of a Latino community, she takes on that little Hispanic accent. If she's in front of a Black community, she puts the jibe on. If she's in front of white folks, she has not a trace of an accent at all. She has a superpower for talking and talking and talking. And by the end of the sentence or paragraph or 5 minutes, you don't know what the heck she said. It was just word salad. Three, she came from a middle-class family. Let me play for you an example. Now, this is on C-SPAN and is alleged to be her response about sending relief efforts to those in Tennessee and North Carolina. I can't find a clip that has the question, so take that with a grain of salt. And maybe this can apply accurately to another topic where it seems to make sense and be gracious and caring. I don't know. I'll leave that up to you. Check it out.
It is our lowest income communities and our communities of color that are most impacted by these extreme conditions and impacted by issues that are not of their own making. And so we, absolutely. And so we have to address this in a way that is about giving resources based on equity, understanding that we fight for equality, but we also need to fight for equity, understanding not everyone starts out at the same place. And if we want people to be in an equal place, sometimes we have to take into account those disparities and do that work. It is our lowest income.
Okay. If I understood that correctly, something along the lines of lowest income families suffer worse than other families from natural disasters and should be the highest priority on the end of receiving aid list. Here's the next example. I'll let it talk, speak for itself.
In terms of building.
Going from a show to a whole entire company, what is your kind of your economic plan moving forward for people who are living paycheck to paycheck and struggling for groceries and rent and homeowners?
So, look, I grew up, so my sister and I were raised by our mother. We lived for a long time in an apartment on top of a child care center. That child care center was actually owned by a woman who lived two doors down from us, Mrs. Shelton, who was by all of our accounts and feelings, our second mother. She helped raise us. And so she was a small business owner. So I'll start with the small business and congratulations on what you guys have done. I, from a child, knew who our small business owners are, right? I mean, you're business leaders, but you're also civic leaders. You take seriously your voice and how you can mentor, how you can grow, right? Communities and the sense of communities. I love our small businesses. And so a lot of my work in terms of building and growing the economy has focused on small businesses. And my vision overall is we need to build an opportunity economy in which we increase opportunity for all, including small business owners. So a lot of my work, even in the Senate, was about increasing access to capital through our small businesses and in particular through our community banks. So I've been responsible for billions of dollars more now going into our community banks because they're in the community and then they know who's in the community and where the talent is and who's doing good in the community, what the community wants. And so part of my plan as president
is going from a
I don't know. I guess give money to small banks, local banks, and support small businesses. That's all I got from that. Took her 2.5 minutes to say it. Well, this is going to be an interesting election season. On the one hand, we have Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, who's an interesting cat in his own light. On the other side, we have former President Donald Trump. And just recently heard yesterday, day before that, that not only is RFK Jr. going to be on his transition team, but Tulsi Gabbard is as well. Vivek Ramaswamy is as well. And there was a fourth guy. Oh, goodness, I'm not going to be able to remember his name. But I thought that was kind of exciting. So, I hate this next one. The soft white underbelly of Hollywood. This is always such a tenfold topic, too, because people take it all the way down to the depths of hell. Some folks just completely discount it and say that's how those people are. Some people justify it. Some people don't care. Some people look at it and think it's vile and disgusting at the surface without having to dig down into what all really could possibly be lying there underneath the surface outside of the view of folks who are in that social circle. To preface this next story, I'm going to play a clip. This is an older clip of Shirley Temple. And in case you don't know the name, Shirley Temple was a child star. She may have been the original child star. She played in quite a few movies as a little tiny girl. Garnered quite a following. Her movies, black and white. Of course, she did a lot of singing and dancing and cute little skirt or dresses. And she just played this adorable little child. Here's an interview from, looks like it's 1988, a long time ago, and she looks like she's in her, I don't know, late 50s, early 60s at this point, and she's recounting a trip that she made to Hollywood to meet a producer, what she thinks is a producer, for the potential for starring in, I believe, probably another movie at this point.
I went to MGM for one picture, thank goodness, only one. And when I got there with my mother, we were separated. She went into the office of Louis B. Mayer, and I went into the office of Arthur Freed. And he was going to talk to me about a movie he wanted to put me in. I'm 12 years old, you know. And I thought he was a producer, but instead he was an exhibitor. And I'd never seen anyone naked before, except myself. So I had no clue about what was happening. And So it struck me so funny, I laughed at him, and I laughed uproariously. I had tears, you know, and he got infuriated. And he said, out, 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 go.
So did you tell your mother?
Well, I went down. I was very quiet. I went down and met her in the lobby of the administration building. She came out very quietly from Louis B. Mayer's office, and we walked hand in hand silently to the car, which was unusual. We got in the car driving home. I said, Mom, you won't believe what happened to me. And I told her what happened, and she got kind of quiet. She said, well, you don't know what happened to me. And Louis B. Mayer wasn't as bad as Freed was to me.
He tried it.
He came on to my mother. And so we both decided that we didn't like MGM much. It was, you know, it was better at Fox.
It's not funny at all. It's good, I guess, for her that she could make light of it and laugh about it, because that type of thing traumatizes some people, has the potential to traumatize some people. And that's not just casual behavior for a grown man to expose himself to a 12-year-old girl. Makes me wonder if that type of behavior is not normal. 12-year-old girl. Looking at his Wikipedia page, well, he had been dead for 15 years, roughly, by the time she did that interview. So it's not like I'm going to go back and read and find out that he had been brought up on charges or that this charge had been brought to light. He'd been dead. Goodness gracious, why didn't she come forward sooner? So from then to now, it looks like this hasn't gotten any better. In 2005, when Sean Combs, also known as Diddy or Puff Daddy, hosted the MTV Video Music Awards, the network advertised the broadcast with a playful star-studded spoof called Diddy Parties, in which the events he hosted were referred to as hedonistic romps. It's one of many examples to illustrate how the powerful music mogul's reputation for hard partying was an accepted part of the pop culture discourse. But since Combs' arrest on charges of racketeering, conspiracy, and sex trafficking this month, the lifestyle at the center of the criminal case has taken on a different light. Those who attended his events, whether his glitzy A-list white parties or the freak-offs described in the indictment against him, have largely refrained from discussing their experience in recent weeks. This hasn't always been the case. In past years, celebrities have openly talked about his public-facing bashes and his general party habits. Here's some of what Combs and other stars have said about his party orbit. In his words, in a 1999 interview with Entertainment Tonight, in response to an interviewer who said, "Your parties are the hottest ticket around," Combs said, "They won't even give me a permit for the parties no mo'. They don't want me to throw the parties no more, but we ain't going to stop. We're going to keep on having fun, bringing people together from all walks of life." He continued, "You're going to hear about my parties. They're going to be shutting them down. They're going to probably be arresting me, doing all types of crazy things just because we want to have a good time. Whenever you bring up a different element into people's environment, things that broaden people's horizons, people get intimidated." In 2002, Combs joined the late-night host Conan O'Brien, who asked what the ingredients were for an amazing killer party. Combs offered a lengthy response starting with, "This is what you need to do. Women, beautiful women, of course. Beautiful men for the ladies, of course. You have to give the ladies what they need, too. You have to take care of your women," he went on. "You need alcohol, as you need some water," Combs continued. "I don't know if guys have noticed this, but a lot of ladies drink water at parties. So if you don't have what they need, they're going to leave. Got to keep them there. Need locks on the doors." "This is sounding kind of dangerous now," O'Brien replied. "It's a little kinky," Combs responded, adding, "You need a lot of heat. Don't have no air conditioning. Heat affects the alcohol. Everyone gets a little more comfortable and loose. Builds up a nice little sweat. That just sounds disgusting, O'Brien quipped. A teenage Justin Bieber posted a YouTube video in 2009 titled Justin Bieber's 48 Hours with Diddy. In it, Bieber appears to be on Combs' property where they look at one of Combs' cars. Where we're hanging out and what we're doing, we can't really disclose, but it's definitely a 15-year-old's dream, Combs says to the camera. I've been given custody of him. He's signed to Usher. I had legal guardianship of Usher when he did his first album. I did Usher's first album. I don't have legal guardianship of him, but for the next 48 hours, he's with me, and we're going to go buck full crazy. 48 hours, Bieber said in the video. Let's go. Let's just go get some girls. Let's go hang with some girls. Man after my heart, Combs answered. That's what I'm talking about. In a 2004 interview with Rolling Stone, the R&B singer Usher Raymond discussed living with Combs in New York for a year in the early 90s when Raymond was 13 years old and building his fledgling career. He was sent there by the music executive Antonio Reed, known as L.A. Reed, to create an album with Combs, who was then in his early 20s. I hesitated there for a second because that name, L.A. Reed, reminded me of Babyface, who was a pretty popular pop musician back in the late 80s, early 90s, Babyface. And the reason I made that correlation was because the record label that he was produced on was called L.A. Face. Raymond told Rolling Stone that Combs had introduced him to a different set of experiences. Sex specifically, he said. This is when he was 13. There was always girls around, he added. You'd open a door and see somebody doing it, or several people in a room having an orgy. You never knew what was going to happen. On an episode of the Howard Stern Show in 2016, Raymond was asked about that year living with Combs. In the 90s, do you understand what that's like? Raymond said. When Stern asked if Combs' house was filled with chicks and orgying like nonstop, Raymond said, nah, not really, but hey, it was curious. I got a chance to see some things. I went there to see the lifestyle and I saw it, he continued, but I don't know if I could indulge and understand what I was even looking at. It was pretty wild. It was crazy. Would you ever send your kid to Puffy Camp? Stern asked. Hell no, Raymond said. In 2009, the rapper Exhibit said he once accompanied Combs to a club after a New Year's Eve party in Miami. Exhibit mentioned seeing nude people engaging in sexual activity at the club. We take off, Exhibit said. We leave the club directly. I didn't say peace to nobody. It was suspect. Khloe Kardashian discussed partying with Combs in Las Vegas during a 2014 episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Her sister, Kourtney Kardashian, guessed which celebrity friends were in attendance, naming Bieber and French Montana, among others. So far, so good, Khloe Kardashian replied, confirming the guesses. Later in the episode, Khloe Kardashian described the party in more detail. I haven't been to bed yet. I got on a plane at 5:30 a.m. for this party, she shared, adding, I think half the people there were butt naked. In a 2018 interview on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, the actor Jamie Foxx discussed partying with Combs. Puff showed up with the SUVs, the FBI, Foxx said about a particular gathering. Puff was always sort of dangerous, so he had all kinds of people following him. Ashton Kutcher briefly discussed Combs in a 2019 episode of Hot Ones before deciding not to veer too deeply into the topic. When asked by the host, Sean Evans, if he had any Diddy party stories, Kutcher said, I've got a lot I can't tell. Can't tell that one either, Kutcher said, mentioning that he was actually cycling through them. Diddy party stories, man, that was some weird memory lane thing, he added later in the episode, shaking his head. Ugh. In a 2021 post to his Instagram story, the rapper Fabulous, discussing how he often ducked out of celebrity-filled events, said he left the party while Combs was still going at 7 a.m. I told Diddy I was going to the bathroom and slid once, he said. Combs Fabulous added, was still turnt. Ice Cube even mentioned, you'll never see him and his bandmate WC, I believe his name was, on No Diddy tapes. There's people who have been trying to quickly distance themselves from him. And a lot of folks over here on the conspiratorial side of the world are just waiting for the party tapes to come out. Allegedly, he has tons and tons of tapes. Allegedly, he filmed everything in his mansions during his parties to use as blackmail material. Much like a fella who just happened to hang himself in jail before getting a chance to testify about who was on his list. I believe his name was something like Roger Epstein. I suspect nothing will come out, and I hope I'm wrong. I really do. I think Diddy's going to make it to trial, and nobody but him is going to get in any trouble, and he won't get in much. We already saw that with Epstein early in his career. He went to, I believe it was prison. For something, got a slap on the wrist, came back out, and was pretty well off. Epstein list shows 166 people connected to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Oh, this is new. Confirmed visitors. Oh, well, that's a little bit different. Confirmed visitors to Epstein Island, 12/21/23, read a January 3rd Facebook post that then listed 166 people, many of them celebrities and world figures, President Joe Biden, former President Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, Beyonce, Lady Gaga, Rihanna, Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks. I don't know. I don't know if I want to go down that rabbit hole right now. But whatever. There you go. I want to get away from this topic. It makes me feel dirty. But Diddy getting arrested happened in September as well. Back to the gloom, the actual gloom in Conyers, Georgia, which is a little bit more regionally focused than national. But if you see the pictures of this, it is scary because it's not like a small fire. A manufacturing facility, a chemical plant that allegedly makes chemicals for pools and spas, had a small fire break out 5:30 last Sunday. They put it out. Water from the roof fire leaked into something inside the plant that was water reactive and created plumes of smoke and chemicals. They issued a shelter in place / evacuation order Sunday morning for the region around there. There were pictures all over the internet. It looked horrible. Thick, black, voluminous, billowing smoke that was coming out of a very large facility. This wasn't like a little small CVS size fire. This was a few Walmarts worth of fire. And folks are worried about that because what is it they're smelling? I mean, surely it's not good for them. There's something called mustard gas that Germany was a fan of during World War I. And if you go dig up Dan Carlin's series on the war on the Western Front, or the Eastern Front, I'm sorry, he spends quite a bit of time going into gruesome detail about the effects of that mustard gas on troops on both sides. Strangely enough, when I went back to look at this story, day before yesterday, the official news release quite contradicts what was originally released. Although the fire, which broke out early Sunday morning about 30 miles east of Atlanta, was producing smells, the Atlanta Fire Rescue Department said in a statement that there were no immediate life safety issues for the city and that a haze was beginning to clear. The Atlanta Fire Department was monitoring potentially volatile organic compounds, it said, including chlorine, hydrogen sulfide, oxide, and carbon monoxide levels. The agency said it requested further testing from the city's Environmental Protection Division. The Georgia Emergency Management Agency sent an alert on Monday afternoon to those within 50 miles of the facility, saying it was monitoring air quality for chlorine and related compounds, but that the chemical levels are unlikely to cause harm to most people. Meanwhile, schools near the plant were closed on Monday, and 17,000 people remained under evacuation orders as officials tried to contain the spread, and the Rockdale County Emergency Management Agency extended a shelter-in-place order for about 90,000 residents. That's kind of scary. Not the first time this year that this has happened that I'm aware of. This makes, in this area, the first large release of chemicals into the atmosphere that I'm aware of. But over the course of this year, there's been two train wrecks that dumped extremely toxic chemicals into rivers. I believe one was in Ohio, and I cannot remember where the other one was. Finally, we get to the last and most recent story in my collection here of what happened in September 2024 version, a little hurricane named Helene. Now, if you listen to podcast number 13 with Jermaine, I opened that podcast saying that we were on the edge of the worst hurricane created in 200 years because every single tropical depression out there begins its life as the worst hurricane of this season. This is going to be a 100-year storm. This is going to be a Category 5. Everybody in Florida is going to get wiped off the face of the map. We get that every daggum time there's a tropical depression out there. And then when it gets into the Gulf, the weather people go insane. Every single time. I have yet to see a weather forecaster on a news station say, this Category 1 hurricane, you should pay attention to it. You should have your emergency preparations already taken care of. And that's it. We'll update you as the information changes. I've never heard that. It's always, you need to start finding somewhere to go. Oh, we're going to get so much rain. The tidal surge is going to be ginormous. So, you know what happened when the boy who cried wolf kept crying wolf? This was the same thing. This is exactly what happened. Now, the National Weather Service did provide information that in retrospect was accurate. 3 or 4 days before this thing got to South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, and created all the devastation that it did. It was out there. The information was out there. The track that they predicted was a bit east of where it wound up. So the areas affected specifically were a bit different than what was predicted early. Ultimately, this thing went through the Tennessee mountains, North Carolina, South Carolina, the mountains and the hill countries up there, dumped a lot of rain on top of already rain-soaked territory. I think they had had steady rain for the previous 4 days, and then this thing comes and dumps another 2 foot of rain on already saturated ground. A couple of dams got real close to being in danger. Last I read, all the dams are fine, no cracks, none. They didn't have to release either one of the two, I believe, that were in danger. In spite of that, in spite of the fact that the dams were contained, flash flooding, mudslides, and rising rivers flooding their banks have wiped out numerous houses, neighborhoods, brought large levels of destructions to towns, overflowed roads, washed out bridges, washed houses and cars down out of the mountains into the rivers, washed houses completely off the sides of mountains, people in them in some occasions. It's pushed over trees. Of course, it's knocked out the power. It's knocked out the internet. It's knocked out the water supply. It's knocked out the sewage treatment plants. It's knocked out the power stations, the power substations, the power lines. That area of the country right now is hurting. This is day 5 today, I believe. And yesterday evening and today were the first time that the National Guard had arrived to the area with supplies, like the first large-scale national efforts to get bulk supplies into that area. I'm not saying it took them 5 days. I'm saying that 5 days after the event was the first time that those residents started seeing anything federal at all. FEMA made it there yesterday morning, I believe it was. And this is all expected. I saw a comment on a forum that in these type of events, first you see American citizens providing relief efforts, then you see the state providing relief efforts, and then you see the federal government resources in the area providing relief effort. Well, it always warms my heart as much as it hurts me to see people in storm damaged areas like that. I've been in one myself. I know firsthand exactly what that feels like, exactly what it feels like to walk outside your house in an area where the sky is usually lit up with lights at night due to all the light pollution and all the noise of the cars and the interstate close by, and hear absolute dead silence because there is no power. The roads are closed. There's trees down. There's no cars on the highway. There's no planes in the air. The airport isn't open. Dead silence. I understand that feeling. And these folks up there in those mountains are even more isolated than I was. I could have walked out it if I needed to. These folks, in some cases, there's no road to walk on. You have to hike up and down mountains to get there, which makes the recovery and the relief efforts much more challenging. So my heart goes out to these folks. It's also refreshing to see the number of folks who have their own helicopters, were loading up supplies donated by other Americans and flying them up there, a lot of them on their own dime. I saw one guy flying a helicopter that cost $2,500 an hour for fuel and maintenance cost, and he was working all day long, spending his own money to get supplies in there to places that were isolated. So Americans, they're loading their trucks up. They're loading up generators. They're loading up water. They're loading up MREs. They're loading up freeze-dried food. They're loading up toilet paper. They're loading up tarps. They're loading up tents. They're loading up lanterns. There are people all over this country right now who can, loading trucks up, and they're on their way to that area to support those people, to help out however they can. This won't make the news. Not the mainstream media news. These kind of things you'll see on local news. So if you're curious, give it a few weeks and you'll start seeing stories of church groups coming in and helping people rebuild their homes, helping people clear their now vacant lots off so that they can start rebuilding their houses on the slab, which is all that's left. America will help its own. God bless this here country. Hopefully October will be way less interesting than September was. Y'all take care of yourself. Take care of each other. See ya.